welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are grateful that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a little bit later in today's show, Dave Thompson and I review the news here in North Dakota, and Matt Olien, our movie reviewer extraordinaire, stops by the Main Street studio. Matt's movie this week, it's a slasher, Clown in a Cornfield. And we begin Main Street today with a discussion about skin cancer, which is the most common cancer in the United States, with melanoma being its deadliest form. Co-host Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner from Conversations on Healthcare discuss the current state of cancer and melanoma with Dr. Mark Holbert.
Well, welcome, Dr. Holbert, to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
May is Melanoma and Skin Cancer Awareness Month, and Melanoma Research Alliance is the world's largest private nonprofit funder of melanoma research. And you directly invested, and this is pretty impressive, $175 million towards scientific discoveries. Are we making progress?
Absolutely. So making progress on the war on melanoma. Since we were founded in 2007, as you noted, we've invested $175 million to 500 projects at the top cancer centers all over the world, top medical universities. And the progress we've made really in the last, a little over the last decade, there's been 17 new treatments approved for melanoma. If you have an early stage melanoma on your skin, you know, that can be cut out by surgery and you're monitored for a few years and usually you're all good. If it has spread throughout the body, which is quite common, if it gets a little too deep into the skin, that's when you need systemic treatments. And like I said, there's been 17 approved. And you know, if you had a metastatic melanoma diagnosis, you know, 15 years ago, it was quite deadly and urgent. And today with these new treatments, we're able to cure about half of patients with metastatic melanoma. So a lot of good progress, but more work to be done.
What's the range of the kind of research that's going on now through these high impact investments?
Absolutely. We just launched, I just announced another $9 million investment to 30 projects. It's across the US, a few countries in Europe and in Australia. So it is a global research portfolio. We are investing in some new ways to tackle melanoma detection, investments in some of these rare melanomas. There's a few rare melanoma subtypes I hope your viewers have learned about or have heard about. Uveal melanoma that starts in the eye, a rare subtype that starts on your hands and your feet called acromelanoma, and then one that starts on the internal mucous membranes, essentially in your nasal cavity, oral cavity, and all the moist internal tissues. And so an investment on the rare melanomas. And then lastly, investing quite heavily in tackling brain metastasis. So when melanoma spreads from the skin or other sites to your brain or to your central nervous system and spine, which is what we call leptomeningeal disease, it becomes very difficult to treat. And so much more research is needed there. So rare melanomas, brain metastasis and CNS disease, and understanding treatment resistance. So really excited about this new group of projects.
One area of funding, which is your supercharging anti-tumor immune responses and enhancing the body's ability to recognize and destroy cancer cells. How realistic is this looking?
Well, it's a proven treatment now. So in 2011, we had the first immune therapy approved called ipilimumab. And then in 2014, two new joined the class, pembrolizumab and nivolumab. And these immune therapies, those first three that I mentioned, they essentially take the brakes off the immune system and let the immune system march forward into the tumor and have an effect. And like I said, this is curing about half of patients with metastatic melanoma. I think importantly for these new immune therapies, they were approved first in melanoma, but now they're used in 24 different types of cancer. And so I think I consider immune therapy the fourth pillar of cancer treatment, right? Mm-hmm. So we have surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and now the fourth pillar since these new treatments evolved is immune therapy. Our new investments are trying to tackle that question. Why doesn't every patient respond to immune therapy, these amazing drugs that have really saved lives and changed lives? And so we're looking at some of the cell-based therapies. You may have heard of CAR T and TIL therapies before. We're looking at some novel ways to stimulate the immune system. The first group of immune therapy drugs sort of take the brakes off the immune system. We're looking at a few research projects of how do we stimulate the immune system to go in and attack the cancer just like it would attack a virus or a bacterial infection.
But we are always worried that the rates of melanoma are continuing to rise, and especially in younger people. I understand cases of melanoma, I think, have tripled in the last 30 years when we're fortunately seeing some diminishment of other common cancers. I mean, when we ask ourselves, why is this happening?
Yeah, we don't know all the reasons. I mean, so melanoma cases did triple over the last 30 or so years. They have flattened out over the last 5 to 7 years. So the incidence, the growth of incidence has slowed a little bit, except for in those younger populations. And, you know, I don't know, I'm a child of the 70s and 80s, and we didn't practice sun safety as much when I was growing up. Right. I think in the 90s and 2000s, hopefully we learned better. But I'm wondering if the next group of teens, if we need to do a continuing the effort of education and practice sun safety. And then there could be other factors around that we just don't know, around climate change or other UV exposures, but definitely need to continually practice sun safety. I like to tell everyone, start your teens, your toddlers and teens young, practicing sun safety. And I also say it's never too late to get started if you're someone of an older generation and haven't practiced sun safety in the past. So wear sunscreen every day, year round, SPF 30 or higher on any sun exposed skin. And then practice wearing long sleeves. There's amazing sun safety apparel now. If you do want to spend a day out on the water, out at the beach, out at the pool, lots of sun safe ways you can do that, but still mean sun safe.
I'm wondering what you can tell our listeners about the overall funding situation for melanoma research.
Yeah, so melanoma research at large is funded by the National Institutes of Health, NIH. The Department of Defense a few years ago launched a specific program called the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. And, you know, we're still monitoring the situation and see what happens. Today, the DoD funding appears secure, and we're monitoring what's happening with NIH. I think we're at this, you know, moment in time with change where the role of philanthropy, the role of nonprofits like the Melanoma Research Alliance is going to be even more critical. You know, nonprofits can move a little bit more nimbly than the government, and we're able to fund innovation and maybe things that are a little bit more high risk, but might be high reward. And so I think it's a changing environment. We're just monitoring to see what's happening and how best we can keep the momentum going. There's so much unmet need, but I think the role of philanthropy is going to be critical these next, you know, 2 to 5 years.
One person every hour of every day will die from melanoma, and there's access to approved treatments. Not such an easy thing. What's the role of your organization in tackling some of those issues?
Detecting melanoma still is an area with an unmet need for research, more technology. And we've invested a fair amount in the past, but it's also one of our urgent investment areas over the next 5 years. So improving detection, and you got it exactly right. Are there tools that we could empower people at home where they could, you know, on an app on their phone, look at their moles and see if there's something that could help make it make you aware if it's suspicious? Are there tools that we could help nurses and primary care doctors to really help cut down on which people are referred to dermatology, where there's something really of concern or not? And so we've invested in some imaging techniques, some other techniques that, you know, aren't ready for prime time today, but I think in the near future, maybe. But we need tools for the individual at home, the primary care doctor, and the dermatologist. And we're investing in those areas and really believe that AI and imaging over time will really help, you know, to help in this detection space. And so we've invested a little bit in the past, and we'll be investing more over the next few years. But definitely dermatologists and primary physicians need more tools to help them.
We've been working with a group out of Denmark, Melitech, on a dermoscope that makes it much easier for the primary care practitioner to get a good image, which is oftentimes it. And there's a lack of dermatology. We cherish our dermatologists. They do such a good job and so important. But we also know getting to the front line, and one would hope soon, as you suggested, maybe there's an opportunity for some home-based access to specialty care right now. But I think there's a lot of interesting work going on in this particular area. Do you have any of those types of intervention models that you're looking at? Our best practices around the country?
Absolutely. The group you work with is fantastic. You know, one of the pilot projects, just as one example of about a dozen projects we recently funded, was at New York University in New York City. And what they piloted was the idea that at a CVS or a Walgreens or a Duane Reade, could you have a place there where you could get, you know, three or four suspicious looking moles examined with a dermatoscope and then have it sent to a central dermatology lab where it would be reviewed by expert dermatologists. And they would refer you either get in quickly or nothing to be concerned about, you know, keep monitoring for the next 6 months. And it proved to work out. And so they have piloted that at NYU. And, you know, look at COVID, you know, when COVID happened, you know, before that time, you didn't always get immunizations at Walgreens and Walmart and CVS. And then we rapidly were able to do that. And could we do something similar for skin health? And that's the dream and the vision. But I still think a little bit more research to be done.
It does seem that MRA is engaged at the prevention, screening, early detection, and then treatment entire continuum. And we probably have questions about all of them. But I want to go to the genetics on this one. I understand there's a new gene-based blood test that has been shown to be accurate in predicting whether some stage 3 melanoma patients are going to experience recurrences of the tumors or not. We're always interested in what is going on in the genetic world around these things. Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's really an exciting time in monitoring cancer through a blood draw, right? You know, essentially what we call liquid biopsy or blood-based biopsy. And yes, so now there's some new tools and new tests that can measure whether you have melanoma or not. If you have more advanced disease, stage 3 and stage 4, you know, when you have thinner tumors like a stage 1, it's harder to detect and they might not even make it to the bloodstream. But for more advanced melanomas, we can measure that. Just even the presence of that at the time of your diagnosis tells us something about your melanoma. We can actually measure in blood whether your melanoma has a BRAF mutation, which is the most common mutation caused in skin melanoma. And then importantly, these blood-based tests can be used to monitor whether you're responding as you get treatment, and then also help augment when you're doing imaging, CAT scans, PET scans, augmenting the imaging test to see if you're having a recurrence. And so I think it's really an exciting time. I've been involved in other organizations before I joined Melanoma, funding liquid biopsy, blood-based biopsy research for cancers since about 2008. And for many, many years, I was saying it's not ready for prime time. But today, I would say the message has changed. There are tests available. Anyone diagnosed with melanoma or any type of cancer, you should ask your doctor if there's any blood-based monitoring tests that could help augment helping your treatment decision-making and monitoring for recurrence.
You know, Margaret, one of the things that we keep a close eye on at the Weizmann Institute are clinical trials and the importance of clinical trials. And you believe that a lack of enrollment in clinical trials is really a large obstacle to bringing new therapies to market. Right now, I believe there are around 400 melanoma-focused clinical trials testing new treatment areas that are currently recruiting patients. And I'm wondering if you can give us a high-level overview of these trials, and also just a reminder of how important for the general population to consider enrolling into these trials.
Absolutely. Well, clinical trials in melanoma today, you know, we have so many new drugs that are the standard of care. And so the new trials are having to compare the new drug, the new agent, the new approach to an amazing standard of care. So this idea that you might be a guinea pig is no longer, you know, that's not valid. So that's a misconception. There are 400 trials. A lot of them are looking at novel immune therapies, novel targeted therapies. I'd say over the last 5 years, cancer researchers have found a lot of new targets within the cancer cell and also within the microenvironment around the cancer cell, how the cancer cell interacts with fibroblasts and other parts of, you know, the healthy tissues where it's growing. And so how can they target the environment as well as the cancer cell? So these 400 trials are new immune therapies, new targeted therapies, combinations of agents. We're also looking at questions, what we call neoadjuvant therapy. Do you give the IV systemic therapy before surgery, before you cut out the melanoma? It's done in other cancers. So giving systemic therapy before you remove the tumor. And it's still in the area of research. It's not yet FDA approved to do neoadjuvant treatment, but there's some suggestion from early clinical trials and from lab studies that giving these immune therapies I've been talking about before the surgery might be more effective. There's the hypothesis by scientists is that there's more tumor antigens around because you haven't cut it out, and that the immune system might be stimulated more to recognize it. Then you could do the surgery and then continue the systemic therapies. So that's what this current bunch of ongoing trials is doing. I will say my message for everyone when I talk about clinical trials, you don't walk down to the Apple store today and say, hey, I'd like an iPhone 1 or an iPhone 2, right? You all want the 14, the 15, whatever generation we're on. So why would you go to your oncologist and say, give me, you know, medicine 1.0? You know, we want the most modern medicine, and that's what clinical trials are providing you today in melanoma.
Well, I'm going to keep bouncing around. You'll all have to forgive me from this prevention, early detection and treatment continuum, because I think melanoma may represent one of the best meta examples of how it all has to work, right? If we're going to do a good job, we have to think about prevention, early detection, screening, and treatment. But, you know, I'm going to start on the treatment end of this now. Patient needs to get to a surgery site where they can have a Mohs procedure or some treatment if they're at an appropriate stage. But across the United States, we have huge shortages, right, of the experts, the primary care, the dermatologist, the specially trained dermatologist for melanoma. What's your advocacy role as an organization in that? Are you working with schools and training programs, trying to develop new generations of, I'm sure, physician assistants and nurse practitioners are also a big piece of that workforce? What are you doing to make sure that everybody can get access when they're diagnosed and that they have coverage to be treated as well, the insurance coverage?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yeah, it's definitely an unmet need. We need more dermatologists, more surgeons, more oncologists, and the staff, the nurse practitioners and physician's assistants that support them. We have a few programs, for example, training new dermatologists interested in melanoma called our Dermatology Fellowship Program. We have another program called the Young Investigator Award, which stimulates new faculty within the first 5 years of their career. But absolutely more work needs to be done on training those. We do encourage anyone diagnosed with melanoma, especially if you have a more advanced stage, you know, stage 2, 3, 4, that you really should do your best to get to an NCI designated cancer center, the National Cancer Institute. There's about 75 of them around the country. They're usually affiliated with top universities and medical schools in your cities and towns. And we do encourage people at least to get a second opinion at one of the NCI designated cancer centers. If it's a few hours drive away, go there for a second opinion, and then you maybe could still get treatment locally back home once you sort of know what is the right treatment path for you. And so that's where we encourage people. But absolutely, there's a need for more physicians.
You know, Margaret, we talk so much on the show about machine learning, AI, mRNA technology, and CRISPR. I'm wondering how all of those are playing a role in the work that you're doing as you look out on the horizon of new opportunities and new interventions that we may want to keep an eye on.
It's a great question. I think there absolutely will be a role for artificial intelligence, machine learning, especially in melanoma detection and diagnosis. So if we have these imaging tools like a dermatoscope that the dermatologist uses or a primary care physician uses, there are other imaging tests I don't think we have time to get into today, but there are other imaging tools being developed. But any sort of imaging test, anything that measures a change in your mole or a change in your tumor over time is perfectly ripe for being part of AI and machine learning. And so we've invested about $10 million into this space so far, but more needs to be done. But absolutely, I think they will have a role in helping detect changes in moles over time, helping detect when a mole is melanoma and needs treatment. And then there will be a role, I think, in AI machine learning and monitoring patients with known cancer and as they are treated over time. So I think it's an exciting area. AI machine learning can detect changes potentially, you know, that someone with the human eyes can't detect, you know, if you can look at images, you know, microscopic changes over time. And so it's an exciting area that is worthy of more investments.
All right, I'm going to bounce back to prevention and research. We'll tie both of those together. So I had dinner with a friend not long ago who had been visiting her grandchildren in Australia, and she showed me a photograph of the two beautiful school-age boys, and they were both they'd just come out from school, and they were both wearing large kind of floppy hats. And I thought it was amusing because little boys generally are not too keen on that kind of thing. And she said, it's not even a question. In Australia, it's the number one, the highest incidence of melanoma in the world. I don't know if that's accurate, but that was her understanding. And that it is the norm to see children wearing protective headgear and really everybody wearing it. So I wonder what your thoughts are relative to research in human behavior, also an area that we're very interested in, and the Weizmann Institute. I don't see that happening around me in the United States. I don't see it happening at the beach, although maybe with the babies, a little more attention to covering. But what are you doing in terms of research into how you really change behavior to move away from those numbers that we talked about earlier about the significant increase in younger people of melanoma? That's got to require behavioral change. What are you studying? What's effective? Does it have to come from the healthcare provider? Is it social norms? Tell us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We definitely need to do more to educate the public on it. And like I suggested earlier on, maybe we've made some progress in the 90s and early 2000s, and maybe we need to double down on efforts, right, on sun-safe behaviors. Absolutely. We've funded a few projects that were piloting ideas on social media locally to see if they could get the public and people, you know, to improve their knowledge about sun safety, not just sunscreen, which is critical every day, year round, reapply if you're going to be outdoors for more than 2 hours, but also some of these long sleeves, these hats, sunglasses, other things to prevent directly exposing your skin to the sun. And we need absolutely to do more of that because it is a behavioral change across society. And absolutely, Australia leads the way in sun safe behavior because melanoma is so critical down there.
Yeah. Dr. Herbert, I think our listeners would be interested if you could share how you got involved in melanoma research and advocacy and leading this effort.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that question. I'm a scientist by training. My background's in pharmacology or drug development for the lay listener. And I've worked in neuroscience for a decade and then diabetes for about 5 years. And then I moved into cancer research just over 20 years ago. I spent most of that time in the breast cancer field, and I moved over to Melanoma Research Alliance 7 years ago, quite honestly, because I was very excited by these new immune therapies. I think stimulating the immune system to attack cancer, just like it goes after a virus or bacteria, has been a game changer in melanoma and now more than two dozen other types of cancer. And I think balancing that immune therapy with abnormal cancer cells will be the way that we cure many, many types of cancer going forward.
And perhaps one more question on my end. You're a big advocate, obviously, to try and find this early and treat people effectively, but also the message that melanoma does not discriminate, that anybody, no matter your age, no matter your ethnicity, no matter your racial background, can get this, and that you, in fact, are seeing rare melanomas more often in patients with Black, Hispanic, or Asian ancestry. What's the message that you want to get out there to all people about screening?
Yeah, so everyone should practice sun safety, all races, all ethnicities, anyone, any race, any ethnicity can get skin melanoma, can get melanoma. And particularly people with darker skin tones, Black, Asian, Hispanic, they should be cognizant of changes, moles or abnormal nevi, blisters on their hands and feet. They can get these rare melanomas, acral melanoma on their hands and feet. And they just need to be aware that melanoma isn't always just a brown spot on your shoulder. You know, it could be on your hands or your feet or under your fingernail beds. But I think the key message is any race, any ethnicity is susceptible to melanoma, and everyone needs to be aware about their own skin and changes in their body over time.
You know, I'm sure, Margaret, a lot of people who are listening to this want to know more about MRA's work. Tell us how people will get in touch of the work that you're doing. Is there a place that they can go on the web to find out the latest research?
Absolutely. I would encourage the listeners to Join us at Cure Melanoma, our website. You can subscribe to our e-newsletter. It goes out every month with usually 4 to 5 new features, new research highlights, new breakthroughs. We're very excited. This springtime of year, there's a lot of cancer conferences. I'm sure many of you follow it, and many of your listeners do. And so we'll be reporting in a few weeks from now from the ASCO conference. But really would welcome any of your listeners to join us at curemelanoma.org.
That was Dr. Mark Hulbert with the Melanoma Research Alliance in a Conversations on Healthcare with co-host Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner. Still to come on Main Street, our news director Dave Thompson and I review this week's news in North Dakota. Matt Olean and I chat about the movie Clown in a Cornfield. It's a slasher movie Matt really doesn't like. And we'll have another report from Our Living Lands. That's all ahead on Main Street today. Stay with us.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
The music ushers in our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson. Dave, happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday, Craig.
Lots to cover in this week's news, Dave. Another huge story in the state of North Dakota right now are its wildfires. I think the rain that we're going to experience today and maybe through the weekend will help, but what's the latest?
Well, the latest is that most of the fires are contained, but they're still burning. And you're right, the possibility of rain coming, you know, throughout the weekend is going to really help on that. The trouble has been the strong winds. The strong winds are horrible, and they're blowing, you know, whatever fire, you know, and they're growing because of that. But firefighters have done a pretty good job of trying to contain them. So far, we haven't heard of too many buildings being burned. A couple of structures up at Turtle Mountain have been burned, but so far, no injuries. And that's a good thing.
Dave, property taxes are still in the news. We thought maybe that for a while after the legislative session ended with property tax relief, at least I thought maybe we wouldn't be talking about this for a while. But in fact, the North Dakota League of Cities is working with other groups to hold property tax planning sessions this summer. What's that about?
Well, they're worried about the caps. You know, some local governments are worried about the caps and what does this mean? And how can they circumvent the caps? There are ways to, but it takes a vote of the people. So it's all going to be training here. Now, I also interviewed the person from Mandan, who's a city administrator, and he said something interesting. He said, there is a perception that these 3% caps do deal with valuations of your property, and they don't. And he said, we have to do a better job of explaining that too.
The 3% cap has to do with the budget of the entity.
Correct. Yes, that's correct. And talking about one of the examples that was cited by the League of Cities, you have a city that 3% is $600. So what are you going to do with the $600? You really can't buy new equipment with that because new equipment is pretty expensive. So you're going to have to think about, putting money in the bank and getting interest off that money, things like that, to make sure that you have some money down the road to replace some of these high ticket items.
Or make budgets leaner.
That's true.
Dave, a fun story. Devil's Lake, no surprise to me, has been named one of the best fishing lakes in the United States.
It made the top 18 list. And when you think about the number of lakes there are in this country, making that top 18 list is a no small feat. And it's good because it's a year-round lake. It has a lot of people who come up for fishing tournaments during wintertime. Ice fishing is very big on Devil's Lake. And that was one of the things that, you know, this group called Fishing Bookers said, that, you know, it's year-round. You get year-round experience. You have great perch. You've got great walleye. You've got northern pike, all sorts of species there. And people who are anglers are taking advantage of that.
All right, if North Dakota students aren't talking about this, I guarantee you in August they will be.
Oh, yes.
And there'll be questions about the cell phone ban in North Dakota schools. What's the latest, Dave?
Well, the latest is it was brought up in this cabinet meeting, you know, the student cabinet that the Department of Public Instruction has. And students are concerned because they do use their cell phones as learning tools, and they're wondering if this is going to be a ban from bell to bell. Does that mean they can't use cell phones for learning tools, or maybe their iPads or something like that? So there's going to be some discussion on that. It is supposed to, you know, students are not supposed to have access to cell phones. And, you know, the idea behind that is pretty good. You know, you don't want people calling during school day, or you know, standing at your phone looking at texts. But there is a flip side to that. So there are some discussions to be had.
The wheels are spinning in many students' minds trying to figure out workarounds for this. My favorite so far has been some students said the laptops provided by schools are horrible. Can I just use my own with my own apps?
Well, that tells you something.
Scroll social media all day long.
Yeah. But that tells you something about, you know, the laptops being maybe substandard.
Well, maybe, or
they just need an excuse.
Make us wonder what these students want to have their own laptops for.
Sure,
that exactly. They won't give it to the school's IT department prior to using them in school.
No.
Dave, North Dakota has added incentives now for businesses to subsidize child care. That's work out of the North Dakota legislature. What's that about?
Well, basically, Senate Bill 2282 is basically giving a tax credit to businesses that subsidize child care. You know, it doesn't directly go to the parents, because that was another discussion entirely, but maybe this incentivizes business to set up their own daycare centers. And maybe it incentivizes business to give some of their employees some money to help pay for daycare.
I always tell this story about when my wife worked for a physician in Wyoming, comes to work the first day under trying circumstances, a member of their staff was actually dying of cancer.
Oh, gee.
But the first thing the physician did was said, oh, by the way, bring all of your childcare bills to me. I'll pay them.
Wow.
And for a young family in Wyoming with three kids, that was such a blessing.
Absolutely.
Dave, what are you working on?
Well, you know, talking about the property tax interviews that I've done got me thinking, you know, the education, K-12 education got a 2.5% per year increase. They were expecting some in the neighborhood of 4% per year. So we're kind of digging into that a little bit. Why was it 2.5%? And what is going on in terms of, you know, budget plans in case there is a special session? So, you know, some more discussions that I'm having with some of the people who are very involved in K-12 education, higher education, and also government in general.
Dave, have you looked at your crystal ball? Is it likely there'll be a special session, or is it still too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell, but given, you know, what happens with the big, beautiful bill in Congress this week might, you know, make it clearer about whether or not lawmakers are going to have to come back in special session.
There'll be some ramifications that will affect cities and states.
Absolutely.
And certainly what states are going to be required to perhaps pay for in the future that the federal government has taken care of prior.
That is correct.
We review the news each and every week, each and every Thursday, actually, here on Prairie Public with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, enjoy the weekend.
Thank you, Craig. You too.
Gather around, everybody.
There's the fanfare we hear each and every Thursday on Main Street. That means it's time for one thing, and that's a great movie review from our movie reviewer extraordinaire, Matt Olien. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Okay, Matt, we have my least favorite genre to talk about today. The movie that you're going to review is Clown in a Cornfield. It's a slasher movie. Here's the trailer. Look out!
They're really big on tradition around here.
Every year, there's this parade where everyone gathers around a friend of float.
Friend of?
It's the clown on all the Bay Pen corn syrup labels. He's practically a local legend.
Smile, Philly girl. You're about to become a sensation.
careful who you hang out with. There's some real weirdos at this town.
Matt, now that we've seen the trailer, how does Clown in a Cornfield stack up against other slasher films that use rural America as their backdrop? And oh, by the way, don't go standing by the cornfield, please.
I think the title here says it all, right? Yeah. I'm done. That's our review for this week. No, we'll keep going. Yeah, this is not my genre either, Craig. And let me just say right now, the product in theaters right now is really slim. Really slim until May 30th when we get the film Friendship and also The Phoenician Scheme, Wes Anderson's new movie. It is slim pickings out there right now. I would say people go see Sinners. If you haven't seen Sinners, that's a good horror movie. This is not, however. Clown in a Cornfield, directed by Eli Craig. I mean, the title says it all. It's kids in rural Pennsylvania, the town of Kettle Springs, and there's a, you know, long-standing town secret of murders and things like that. And basically, the main character is Quinn, played by Katie Douglas, who's a 26-year-old actress, playing a high schooler, of course, here. And her father, Aaron Adams, who plays the new town doctor. They relocate to the small town to kind of get a fresh start. They're living in an old house. I mean, you know, this is paint by numbers stuff, right, Craig? I'm telling you right now, we've seen this all before.
How can we not like Friendo, Matt? Come on.
Friendo, yes, the clown or clowns. You'll have to see the movie or not see the movie. I didn't care for this at all. It tries to play it for jokes. It's definitely a send-up of the old teen slasher movies like Friday the 13th and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't find it terribly funny. I didn't find it very good at all. This is not my genre. However, I will say I loved Sinners. So that's a horror film I like because that was stylish. It had some attention to plot detail with the Delta Blues thing going on. This one is just basically teen slasher. The acting is really over the top, especially by the local townspeople, the rednecks. You don't need to draw your roadmap to tell you what kind of acting is going on there. Cardboard characters. And I would say, too, when the shocks come, you kind of know they're coming. I wasn't shocked at all. You know the gore is coming. It's going to be heavy gore that happens. You know, it's the old which teenager is next, right, for the clown. Didn't care for this at all. It's a low-budget film. It did make $3.9 million at the box office opening weekend. That's pretty good for a low-budget horror film like this, but boy, there wasn't many people in it when I saw it. So this is definitely a thumbs down for me. Not my genre. I fully admit that. Here's the other thing I'll admit, Craig. I've seen so many movies, and I know how they're made. I know how they're edited. I know how the shocks are done. There's a point now where I just can't get scared at a movie anymore. I have to suspend my belief, and I did in Sinners. I really did. But for this one, I knew when they were coming. I knew when the axes were coming and the pitchforks and, you know, the chainsaws and everything like that. And so it's almost a curse for me that I know how movies are made because it's lessened my enjoyment of horror slasher movies because I know when the beats are coming. I know when the editing's coming. It's like Orson Welles once said, once he started making movies, he said his enjoyment of them somewhat was lost because he could always hear the director yelling cut when he was watching a film. That's not the point for me. I can sit back and enjoy a film, of course, and analyze it. But with shock films like this, it takes a lot to scare me anymore or make me jump.
Matt, the other question that I have is the movie, as I understand it, touches on economic decline and generational resentment. Are all of those things lost in the blood and in the fog and in the noise of the chainsaws and all of that stuff?
Great question. Answer is yes. Any kind of message they're trying to get across about a generation gap or whatever is completely lost in this movie, for sure.
All right, Matt, let's move along. Robert Benton passed away.
Yes, age 92, won the Oscar for Best Director for Kramer versus Kramer back in 1979, which really kind of got him going as a director. He started as a screenwriter, and he co-wrote the screenplay to Bonnie and Clyde, and that's really was his early claim to fame, was co-writing that screenplay to Bonnie and Clyde, which, of course, is a movie that really changed the film industry going forward. So he was 92, and he made some other really good films like Nobody's Fool with Paul Newman. So Robert Benton has passed at age 92.
All right, Matt, let's turn to the Oscar trivia part of our program, and it's a two-parter. And, of course, we have to talk about a slasher movie first. This movie was released on all days of Valentine's Day in 1991, and then it won Best Picture at the 64th Academy Awards in 92. What was the movie?
The Silence of the Lambs.
All right, now let's expand this, Matt. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Three films in Oscar history have won the Big Five Academy Awards, including Silence of the Lamb. And I'm talking about Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director, Best Picture, and Best Adapted Screenplay. Which are the other two?
It Happened One Night, 1934, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975.
Stunning, Matt, is your trivia knowledge. We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me, and so is knowing the scoop. Like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer, that kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience-wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As we approach another summer storm season, coastal archaeological sites are in increasing danger. In this Encore episode, KUCB Sophia Stewart Rossi reports on researchers in Alaska's Aleutian Islands who are working to preserve indigenous artifacts from storms and rising sea levels.
Only a few feet away from the Uducton archaeological dig site, waves from a storm are crashing into the shore. This historical hotspot sits on the Bering Sea coast, exposed to erosion and intense weather. Scientists expect climate change will make these storms even stronger. So for the past couple of years, archaeologists have been regularly excavating the site before it's too late. Intern Tatum Robinson was sorting through a bag of ancient fish, bird, and mammal bones from the site earlier this year and found something unexpected. She describes it as black, shiny, and oblong-shaped.
Once I picked it up, I knew exactly what it was. It was a labret.
A labret is a jewelry piece for a lip piercing. According to the Kowloon tribe of Unalaska, it was historically worn in the lower middle lip of both Ununga men and women as a sign of maturity. Robinson is Ununga herself.
I had like such a good day the rest of the day because I was so excited.
The Ununga people have lived in the Aleutian Islands for thousands of years and still do, but many of their heritage sites have been lost due to repeated colonial displacement, and now climate change is the latest threat. Roberta Gordioff was the lead archaeologist for this year's Uducton excavation. Her grandfather's family is from Unalaska, and her work focuses on links between the Aleutian Islands and northern Norway.
They're quite similar. Island environments, maritime, subarctic. They're hunting similar species. They're living in similar environments.
The Uducton site is in Dutch Harbor, one of America's top fishing ports. The docks are bustling with tractors and other heavy machinery. The deep ice-free waters in Unalaska draw a busy flow of vessels from around the world, many people note from the popular TV show Deadliest Catch. And for thousands of years, the bay has been a popular spot for Ununga people too. Archaeologist Virginia Hatfield has been doing research in the Aleutians since the 90s. She's also the director of the Museum of the Aleutians, the organization leading the excavation. She says learning more from the dig site can help bridge the gap between the Kowloon tribe's past, present, and future.
And the archaeological site has a lot of significance, so they also care about their heritage and they do not want to let anything happen to it.
Unalaska isn't the only place where heritage sites will be impacted or destroyed by climate change. Associate Professor Matthew Howland at Wichita State University estimates tens of thousands of sites are at risk, including those in Georgia, Florida, and other parts of Alaska. He says rising sea levels make it easier for coastal storms to become stronger. Howland says the first step in preserving heritage sites is to understand the extent of the problem through archaeological surveys and using digital technologies like laser scanning.
And the next stage is to understand which sites are the most important to try to protect, because we certainly won't be able to protect all of them.
Howland adds that securing funding is also a big part of the solution. Back in Unalaska, the local Native Corporation is funding the Uduktun project. So until further notice, archaeologists will continue to search through the bags of collected bones, uncovering more invaluable pieces of Ununga heritage. Robinson, the archaeology intern, is continuing to find historical artifacts, like the top of a fishing hook made of bone. Typically, they're hard to find.
The carving was so intricate. It was one of the most beautiful things I've been able to find. And then a lot of needles, which was really cool.
The Uduktun dig site is now closed for the winter and spring. A weighted tarp shields it from strong storms ahead. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 15th. Even as he was overseeing the Civil War, President Lincoln was determined to move the country forward. In 1862, he signed several bills into law that directly affected Dakota Territory and, by extension, the land that would become the state of North Dakota. The Homestead Act spurred westward expansion and the Euro-American settlement of the Great Plains. The Morrill Act established a land-grant college in every state. That led to the North Dakota Agricultural College, which later became North Dakota State University. Often overlooked in competition to those more famous acts, the United States Department of Agriculture was also established on this date in 1862. In what would be his final annual address to Congress, Lincoln called it the People's Department. Lincoln's upbringing on a poor Kentucky farm may have influenced his interest in agriculture. He understood what it meant to live off the land. This new department laid the foundation for advancing American agriculture. At the time, about half of all Americans lived on farms. Lincoln saw the Department of Agriculture as a way to support food production and help settle the West. He appointed Isaac Newton as the first Commissioner of Agriculture. Newton had a strong interest in innovative farming. His goals included collecting agricultural data, introducing new plants and animals, testing equipment, and establishing a library. He also placed a high priority on education. In the years that followed, the USDA earned a respected place in the federal government. President Grover Cleveland elevated it to a cabinet-level department. In 1914, the Smith-Lever Act funded the teaching of agriculture and home economics. During the Great Depression, the USDA helped struggling farmers continue to produce food. Today, North Dakota farmers and ranchers still benefit from Lincoln's vision. The USDA's mission is to provide effective, innovative, science-based leadership in agriculture. Programs support sustainable farming, water conservation, and farmable wetlands. The USDA also provides disaster assistance, emergency loans, and educational outreach to keep producers informed and resilient. Over 150 years later, Abraham Lincoln's vision lives on. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
All right, time to play along. Here are some clues to the identity of our guest at our first ever live in-session event.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
You talking to me?
He's an importer-exporter, okay?
Get it, get it? He is Rob, I assume that's short for Robert Port, the much-read opinion columnist and podcaster. And he'll be with us Thursday, May 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Craftwell Event Center in downtown Fargo. We'll be talking lots of legislature and other issues on the minds of North Dakotans. And if reading Rob Port has ever made you feel seen and heard or seething with disagreement, well, you'll get a chance to ask Rob anything you want. Just bring your North Dakota and Minnesota nice, please.
You have no call to get snippy with me. I'm just doing my job here.
You can reserve your free tickets now at prairiepublic.org.
And that's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Coming up on Friday at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. He asks the question, how are tariffs affecting you? And at 7 p.m. Central on Friday, it's one of my favorite NPR shows, Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again Monday, right here on Main Street.